I told the guys on my other podcast about Zest, and now we use it too.
Oh, super. Dude, you're diluting the brand.
I know. Jeez. It was just so easy. It was so easy to go there. Zest.
No good.
You know, if something works, I'm not above using it for multiple purposes.
Yeah, as long as I get royalties.
Okay. Oh, of course. Of course. Yeah, that's not nearly as popular as our podcast.
Oh, that's good.
It's a very, very small following. Not the gobs and gobs of people falling over themselves to come be hopnologists with us.
The tens of them.
The tens of them.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Hopnology Podcast.
Here we are.
I'm your cruise director, Greg. And your bartender, James, is here as well.
The shuffleboard on the Lido deck.
There you go. The cruise analogy is not a bad one because, we're talking about breeding today. And, I mean, let's face it, there's plenty of that going on a cruise ship, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah. Well, certainly during spring break.
Mm-hmm. Well, when it's not the 70s plus cruise ship.
Oh.
And then yeah. I just, well, maybe we shouldn't have even gone there. Okay. Anyway.
Yeah, let's maybe change the subject.
Very quickly. So a little bit of housekeeping, though. We do have another fine farm joining us on the Patreon. Danielle from New Brunswick, Canada at Split Rock Farm. So welcome aboard. Happy to have you.
Lovely to have you.
Hope you get a lot out of the old back catalog there and send us some questions. Send us some questions. We'd love to hear more from all of our friends in Canada. We have a pretty good following in Canada.
We do. Yep. Done a lot of consulting up there too over the years.
I won't make any, you know, strange brew Canada jokes. No. They're just too easy.
They are.
Too easy. That's a movie I haven't seen in forever. I should watch again.
It's pretty brutal, but it is good.
It is good. I just rewatched Spinal Tap last week for the first time in about 10 years.
Ours go up to 11.
I'm running through all the old stuff again. I watched that, and the week before that, I went through The Big Lebowski again.
Never seen it.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Okay.
Yeah,
All of you on the Discord, ping James. What do you mean you haven't seen The Big Lebowski?
Shame me more than you already do, yes.
Wow. Okay. Well, you know, anything you're about to say for the next, you know, 40 some odd minutes, your expertise has been called into question for life in general.
Well, I was getting ready to drop some sciencey science on you, but you know what? The hell with you people.
Sorry, I was drinking a beer. No can pop tonight because it's a bottle and there's no sound from a bottle. If I try to open a bottle in front of the microphone, I'll probably screw it up and drop it, and then the sound you'll be hearing is my computer shorting out.
Yeah, it takes you long enough to figure out which buttons to turn on anyway, so it's best just to stay away from those things.
I think it's all plugged in right now. Yeah, everything's appeared to be plugged in. We're good. We're good to go.
Super.
Oh, my. So, breeding.
Breeding.
We're going to talk about breeding tonight. And this was, you know, we're a broken record at this point. It came up on the Discord.
Yep. Well, I asked specifically, what do you guys want to hear about? What can we talk about? And it came up as like, well, breeding new varieties and how do you do it? And, you know, I want to do, this is going to be this is the panacea. This is really what's going to break small scale, non-traditional hop growers, you know, loose from the chains of oppression. I'm like, let's slow your roll. I think first what we need to do is talk about the science, which is the how, and that's what this episode will be about. And then we really need to devote an entire episode to the why.
Sure.
As in, why the hell would you want to try and do this? Now, you can do it for fun and for shits and giggles, but most of us as small-scale growers have issues scraping up pennies to keep our farm running, let alone fund a breeding program, you know, intent on intellectual property development.
Yeah, because that's really what it is. It's a breeding program. Mm-hmm. This is... Dare we say it? It is science once again. It is scientific method. It is tests and controls and plans and all that annoying stuff that gets in the way of profit.
Gets in the way of rock star hop grower. We'll talk about the why later, but today let's talk about the how, because I know there's And it's a very popular topic of not just on our Discord, but also just pretty much on every forum I'm a part of. And I typically just keep my mouth shut because, you know, believe it or not, after 20 years of doing this, I finally figured out just to keep my damn mouth shut.
How's that working out for you?
Depends on how much I've had to drink, really.
You know, and I'm asking you how it's working out for you, but really the rest of you should be asking me how it's working out, him keeping his mouth shut. I got opinions.
So yeah, let's talk sciencey science today because people, you know, haven't had enough of that recently.
Well, it's good every once in a while to lay, to, you know, smack them down with some cold, hard facts. And
right.
I heard there might be some math.
Yes.
Nice.
There's math involved.
Okay.
Excellent. Mostly as an illustration. But let's start things off relatively slow. Let's talk about genetics. This idea of, you know, for those of you who can remember science class, Gregor Mendel and his peas, breeding peas back and forth, and lo and behold, the plants that he got out of his crossbreedings, the pods were shaped differently, or the plants were shaped differently. And this was really the first instance of humans intentionally tracking the transfer of genetic material, genetic information, I would say, between species, right? We kind of had this idea of like, well, we're all a little bit different, but we're all still kind of same. But we really didn't have this idea of we can select for this stuff.
Yeah.
Sure, you can select for it if you have a map. And the map is absolutely critical. And anyone who's had a genetics class, certainly is a biology student, like college, takes entire, you know, semesters on genetics, running through what we call Punnett squares, where we're doing different crosses of different traits to see, you know, are you going to have blue eyes or brown eyes? If your mother's dominant and your father's recessive, how does this, all this stuff work? And, you know, you can do that for one trait, let's say, because humans have two sets of chromosomes, right? That's chromosomes are basically a collection of our genes, right? Chromosomes are the neat little package that our DNA is wrapped up into.
X's and Y's.
Well, pretty much. Well, and those are sex gametes, but I don't even want to go into that. When you do the chromosome shuffle, when mom and pa get together, there's two different types of cells really in your body, right? We call them somatic cells, which is 99.9% of what you as a meat sack is made up of. And then there's this tiny percent, right, called the sex gametes. And you just talked about X's and Y's. And so the sex gametes are special cells that have actually only half the number of chromosomes. Why? Because if you're a human and you're made up of, let's say, 20 pairs of chromosomes, then if you're going to inherit something from your mother and your father, you both can't be going into the show each with 20 sets because it's going to be ugly.
Yeah, like Picasso level ugly. Yeah.
If it lives. So even a fraction of a chromosomal error results in horrific things in human offspring. So we go through this process where our sex gametes, our sex cells, sperm and ova, go through a special kind of cell division that basically only gives you one copy of chromosomes. And your partner is going to contribute the other copy, mix them in a big jug, voila, right? A new blend of human. Plants don't work like that. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Everybody keeps saying, well, you know, because I think that's what people think when growers think, I want to start a breeding program, how hard can it be? Right? You just get two and you like the traits of that one, you like the traits of that one, you put them together, you get the best of both worlds. Wrong, because it doesn't work that way. So what happens? Some plants have two sets of chromosomes, and we call that diploid, D-I-P-L-O-I-D, diploidy, which means two sets of chromosomes, as opposed to one set of chromosome, like human sex cells, is haploid or sometimes called monoloidy, but usually haploid. So two sets are diploid, and pretty much all mammals and most animals are diploid, because we reproduce sexually, right? We have contributions made from by the father and by the mother, and the two sexes are separate. They're not on the same species, as opposed to something like, say, an apple tree, which can fertilize itself, right? And do you ever wonder how can a plant, like just like a tomato plant, it produces pollen. It's got eggs in its ovary, and it produces a tomato when it gets pollinated. And how does it not like just get totally mutated, right? Like you would think a human might. Right. If something were like that to happen, it's because most plants have the ability to take on multiple copies of their own genes. So instead of having a diploid or two sets of the same chromosome, they could have three, which might be called a triploid.
Triploid?
Or four, which would be a tetraploid. And so you can go pentaploid and hexaploidy and all the way up to dodecaploidy, where you could have 12 copies of the same chromosome. And you might be thinking, why in the hell is that even a thing? I mean, really? Two's not enough? The reason plants can have so much diversity in their form factor. Think of a rose. How many different kinds of roses have you seen? Or geraniums, or you know, pretty much any flower at the garden center, right?
Sure.
Those are all come about because they have multiple copies of the same genes, and each one of those copies is arranged slightly differently. Let's say instead of playing euchre with a single deck, you're playing with eight decks. And think of how many different combos that you can come up with there, right? And this is not the math part yet, but if we wanted to lay that out and start doing the math, it's just enormous. Just the going from a diploid, two copies, to a triploid, three copies, enormously increases your genetic randomization potential.
Sure.
Okay. Okay, everybody with me so far? Mm-hmm. I'm going somewhere with this.
Yeah, more choices, more variability.
Right. And that actually helps plants and some insects, but not many, and some fungi, rather, to deal with mutations, spontaneous mutations. Because if you've got, let's say you have two copies of a chromosome, and one of them gets mutated, you've got one left. And when you go to pass that on sexually, which one of the two, you've got a 50-50 shot of sending a mutation through that could result in something bad, and, you know, having a non-viable embryo, and then you didn't pass your genes on, and Mother Nature laughs at you. So having more copies increases the likelihood that you are going to pass on favorable traits if something happens in a mutation, because that mutation is going to be very small. If it's very small, in part in a low percentage of the chromosomal region, let's say you have a tetraploid, you have four copies, and you've got an error on one of the copies, you're 75% cool yet, right? And so that mutation could stick around and not become what we call dominant and express itself, because it's going to be outclassed by the other three good chromosomes.
Right.
This is a very, very, very generalized for people, okay? So anybody out there knows their snuff with genetics, I do not want any hate mail. So all that being said, what does that have to do with hops? When we look at what we would call, well, some people call them land race varieties. So let's think all the nobles, all the noble varieties, and even the classic North American varieties, Cascade and Brewer's Gold and Mount Hood and all. Well, yeah, Mount Hood being bred from a land race type, Haltar. Those are all naturally occurring diploid plants. They have two copies of their chromosomes. Totally normal. It happens all over in the environment. Just because it only has two copies doesn't mean it can't have more.
Sure.
At some point in evolution, and it's usually from an environmental mutation mutagen, we call it, like ultraviolet light or environmental stress or things of that nature, that diploid can suddenly, if it reproduces sexually with another plant that might have been influenced by the environment, to become a triploid. So something happens in the pollination where instead of making just two copies of whatever chromosome it is, it makes three. Hmm. Something's different now.
Right.
It's not the same as, you know, a diploid, and a diploid is going to make a diploid. But what we end up with is we end up with a triploid. Or in some cases, usually what happens more likely is instead of a triploid, you end up with a tetraploid. You end up with four chromosomes because it's easy to have a replication error in two chromosomes than it is just having basically a half a replication. Yeah.
Right.
So you end up with this four. And something interesting and magical happens. If you take that tetraploid and you cross it, because it'll produce pollen and that pollen's viable, and you cross it back with a half, or with a diploid, which is two chromosomes, you get a triploid plant. That triploid, we find, has things like increased yield, larger lupulin glands, larger cones, faster vegetative growth.
All good stuff for
you're like,
our audience. Yeah.
This is suddenly, I'm interested.
Everyone who's been listening to this and kind of have paying attention just went, oh, what?
Yeah. Huh? Right. So what we find is that with these triploid types, so you have three sets of chromosomes, you see things like, let me give you an example. Let me look through my data here.
Data in a notebook? Really? You?
Me, yes.
I'm stunned.
Yep. Hold on a second. Okay. So, what we found here, this is just a study, where we had a tetraploid female, so four copies in the female, and a diploid male, two copies in the male, of Brewer's Gold. They get together, they do a little thing. We end up with a triploid Brewer's Gold. It could be male, it could be female, because remember, it's 100 or some seeds in a cone, and each one of those has a 50-50 chance.
Right.
Or so we thought.
Uh-oh.
Not so fast. When you back cross these, what we call polyploidy, multiple ploidies, to something like a diploid, it turns out that you don't get a 50-50 mix. You get more like 2/3 female to 1/3 male. That's interesting. We're not going to go into why, but just take that to the bank. Same thing happens when you're dealing with triploid, forcing triploids, which I'll talk about in a second. This triploid that we just made from crossing a four chromosome with a two chromosome, what we see is, we see this enhanced commercial traits, right? Intense growth and lushness compared to the diploid father. Okay. And even the tetraploidy mother is going to resemble a diploid. So it's got basically a division of two chromosomes. It's got four. So it's not really seeing these enhanced traits. But you kind of need it in order to produce this three chromosome variety. See how tricksy this is getting?
Yeah.
Right? So we also see suddenly that triploid Brewer's Gold goes from an alpha acid of 8.2 to an alpha acid of 14. And we see, oil content go from, 1.8 mils per 100 grams, right, to almost 3. You're like, what in the bloody hell just happened? Now you're getting all excited. You're like, okay, I'm going to take this triploid and I'm going to cross it back with another and I'm going to make some sort of monster mutant. But triploids are sterile. Wah, wah. Triploids don't produce seeds or many seeds. And when they do, they're not viable.
So if you want those triploids, you have to continuously be breeding them.
That's one way to do it. And each time you breed it, you're going to get something a little different. Yeah. Or once you, the only, there's another way to get a triploid, right? Which is basically by poisoning a diploid. Nice. So you treat it chemically and force, basically, you treat it with a mutagen that forces the replication, chromosomal replication error, and you create a triploid. It turns out that some triploids, though, can pass their genes on. So a triploid male pollen can fertilize a tetraploidy or a diploidy female. But a female triploid cannot be pollinated.
Gotcha.
So all this is going to be important when you set up your clinical trials to start breeding your hops. You need to know who to cross with whom and who to do what we call back crossing, which is taking that progeny, that offspring, and back crossing it with, say, its mother or its father. Because in doing that, you tend to, let's say, normalize the characteristics so you don't have such a widespread, like, shotgun approach to the potential different, like, form factors or vigor or disease resistance. You kind of back breed, back cross to normalize those genes out a little bit.
You cross back with the parentage.
Correct.
But you can only do that in West Virginia, right?
And some parts of Kentucky.
Okay.
That works to some extent with hops. It works great with Gregor Mendel and his peas. Mm-hmm. Worked fantastic. Hops are a little bit more complicated because of this whole ploidy thing, because you can have multiple copies, and you could end up, if you're not actually, frankly, counting the chromosomes, you don't know what you ended up with.
Oh, I'm sure.
Right. So, Greg, in your backyard production outfit, are you set up to do chromosome monitoring to know whether you've got haploids, diploids, tetraploids?
I'm not sure I can spell any of them. So, no, yeah. I am not set up for that. That is well beyond.
I think it's pretty simple for folks to say, well, I don't need to do all that. Yeah, you kind of do, because the reason you're thinking of doing this is intellectual property. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to breed a new variety, and it's going to be the hottest thing, and everybody's going to want it, and I'm going to own it, and that's how I'm going to make my fortune in hops.
Right. And to your point before, I mean, if you, there's a difference between breeding your own variety that is repeatable and wild deck hops, that you've got some of them and you can do something with them and people love them. And then the next year you're like, well, there's something else growing on the other side of the deck.
Right. And you'll see that all over, because those are just open crosses. And mm-hmm. those tetraploids, like I said, will pop up in nature every now and again. And when, mm-hmm. if they cross back with that diploid, they're going to make a tetraploid crosses back with a diploid. They're going to make a triploid. A three chromosomer that's going to exhibit markedly different agronomic characteristics. But genetically, if you actually sequence the genome, it would still say it's Brewer's Gold.
Right.
It just happens to have an extra set of chromosomes. Hmm. When that happens in humans, bad things happen.
Sure.
We tend not to like having extra sets of chromosomes. But in plants, it's turned out to be a good thing. But if we look at things like our most common varieties that are bred today, they're all triploids, right? Millennium was a triploid bred from a diploid nugget mother and a tetraploidy numbered father.
Hmm.
Crystal is a triploid variety of Holotower. Twice as high, right, as the cultivar that they were derived from. Those are all triploids. How about one that's much more recent, like, say, Pearl, a triple Pearl? Mm-hmm. Triple Pearl, frankly, is just simply a triploid daughter of diploid Perla crossed with a tetraploidy male.
They didn't even try on that marketing name either. I mean, triple Pearl, they just...
How about that, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it can just go on and on and on. And so that's where these are coming from. So pretty much all of your new varieties that are coming out are these triploid types. And in order to get these triploid types, you've got to cross known ploidy numbers. So you have to know what your plants have for chromosome count. If you don't, you might as well just be playing scratcher tickets, because that's the only way you're ever going to find something that would even be possible to take off, is to just get lucky. No, you've got to track this stuff. And yes, you can send samples out and say, okay, what is this plant? What's the chromosome count? And pretty much most, I'm not going to say plant tissue labs, but most certainly universities have the ability to do this, and some private companies. You can pay to have this done. They're not going to sequence the genome, but they're going to tell you what you have. Because certainly if you've got some diploids, some two X chromosome critters, and you want to force some triploids out of them by doing some of this mutagen exposure therapy, you're going to need to know whether it worked or not.
Yeah.
So you're going to need to have them tested. So I'm going to assume you're doing that, because that's the kind of guy you are. And you're making these notes. So you're gonna cross these plants. And this is where I wanted to sort of get into the numbers game. And let's talk real world implications of this. You've got a standard old diploid cascade, and you have a hop that you think is fantastic that you want to cross it back with. If it's a triploid and you happen to have a male cascade and you're going to try to cross it with a triploid, say triple pearl, nothing's probably going to happen because that female cone is sterile.
Okay.
If you had a male triple pearl and a female cascade, and that male triple pearl pollen was viable, you might get a back cross, right? Or you might not, because that, again, it's the triploid nature really impacts the ability for this plant to pass on its genes. Because you've got three sets of chromosomes trying to cross with two sets of chromosomes. Mm-hmm. Doesn't work so great.
No, someone gets left out.
Yeah, exactly. Four sets versus two sets. Yeah, we can make an even swap there. But three versus two doesn't work so great. So you're really looking at either forcing a diploid to become a triploid through mutagenic exposure, or you are back, or you're crossing a tetraploid with a diploid, a four with a two. So you got to know to start off with. Let's say you have a random old ditch hop, let's call it, or a deck hop, as you like to call them.
Yep.
And you're gonna cross that back with your cascade. So let's say you like, okay, I'm going to try this and see what comes out. And you're like, wow, I really like this. This is pretty cool. And it grows really vigorous and blah, blah, blah. So then you might go back to that parent and the unknown deck hop and have it tested to say, what's the ploidy on this? And then come back, basically say, this is the number of chromosomes. And you would know hops have 20 sets. So as a diploid, if it's like, yep, you got 20 sets. Okay, it's a diploid. If it comes back at twice that number, and you know you've got a tetraploid. Ooh, okay, now that's interesting. Now I'm going to have this offspring tested. Mm-hmm. Is it a triploid? It probably should be a triploid, but not necessarily all of the seeds from that cross are going to end up as triploids. It's not a foregone conclusion.
Right.
So now what are you going to do? Because you're going to have, let's say, even just a single cone that has 100 seeds. You got to plant all 100 of those out. So this is where you start crunching your numbers. Okay. So let's just start with 100 because it's a nice round number.
Right.
That's all we're going to focus on right now. Let's not talk about logistics or feasibility of doing anything different. We're just talking about one cone.
Okay.
So we're going to get 100 seeds out of that. And we're going to say, okay, we know because we tested that we crossed with a tetraploid male with a diploid female. So we're going to plant all of those 100 seeds out because we have to test their viability.
Okay.
So let's say out of those 100 seeds, you get 60 that come up, 60% germination, let's say. If our hypothesis of, see what I did there? Went back to the scientific method.
Mm-hmm.
That our cross of a 4X to a 2X is going to produce 3X genetics. We would expect then that our female to male ratio will not be 50-50. Because female triploids occur at a rate of 2/3 to 1/3 female to male. So one way you could take a look at this is say, okay, I'm going to grow these plants up and 2/3 of them are female. Huh, I must have triploids. That's a good thing. But that's not a sure thing. So you're going to grow up these 60 plants. You're going to look at them. You're going to say, okay, this is my first cross, right? This is my F1 cross. One male, one father, one mother. Produces 60 offspring.
Okay.
So each one of those basically is F1 sub 1, F1 sub 2, F1 sub 3, right? So they are basically all the first generation cross.
Right.
So you're going to grow those plants up. You're going to make notes on how they grow, what their vigor is, how big do they get, how long do they take to get to maturity, what's their yield like, what's their disease resistance like. How long is that going to take? Even just to get to what is a mature cone yield, it's going to take 3 years.
At least, yep.
Minimally. Before you know enough to start crossing again. So you have a plot, let's say from a single cone, of 60 plants in your yard that you have to take care of for 3 years and make notes on every single one of these plants. Detailed notes to know which ones you want to cross with. Now, if 30 of them are male and 30 of them are female, then what are you going to do for crosses now? Are you going to take that male and cross it back, like we talked about before, back crossing? Yep.
Yeah.
Or are you going to say, okay, well, I'm going to take this one now, and I'm going to breed it with this, I'll just use Brewer's Gold because we know it's diploid, and it's a high-seeded variety. So then you do that, you make those crosses on a single cone, which produces 100 seeds, and this one is 80% viable. So you're still screening the first 60 plants, and you've made one new cross that resulted in another 80 plants. And this right now, we are just still screening for agricultural viability.
Right. Very good point, because some of these crosses won't be viable whatsoever.
Right. So you're like, oh my God, of that, at year three, this plant hardly won't climb, right? It won't grab the string, which sometimes happens because it's that particular cross resulted in trichome hairs that are too short or too fragile, so it won't grab and climb. So in nature, it would not have an advantage to reproduce.
Right.
Agronomically, that may not be something we're interested in. So you've got to go through all of those steps to find something that is agronomically viable. And then you usually want to expose that. Let's say I like that one. It's got good yield. It's got good form, you know, good sidearms, short nodes, has the potential to produce a lot of cones, right? So that has agronomic value. It seems to be fairly downy resistant. Okay. That's also important to know. Mm-hmm. But it is an aphid magnet. let's say it's got a thin cuticle. I don't know why. Whatever. That's not the end of the game. Because you can put up with that. If it's got all these other traits that you like, because what can you do? You can cross it again.
Ah.
Right? You can say, I like all of this, but I'm going to cross it with one that I know has strong aphid resistance. So, and see what I can get out of that.
Right. And while hoping that the other beneficial traits don't get lost in that cross.
Exactly. That's exactly right. So we've only done two crosses and you've got a part of your hop yard that's got 120 to 200 plants in it that you're tracking for information to understand how you want to cross it again. And we have yet to test it for brewing quality. Because you could get all the way through this and you could do your crosses and you could back cross 2, 3, 4 times and to breed in the traits that you find most desirable, or I should say breed out the least desirable traits. Mm-hmm. That's usually what you're doing.
Yeah.
And have something that's agronomically fantastic, but has absolutely no star power in the brewing industry.
Right.
And so now you're 6, 7, 8 years into this, and you've got 200 to 500 crosses in the field. And all the data and all the testing, genetic testing that you're doing to check the ploidy numbers and trying to do some estimated breeding, only to find that the varieties that you produced are not of economic importance.
Right. Interesting. I wonder how often that occurs, that you get one that grows really well, but there's just no value whatsoever in the beer. And if that's the case, is there value using it some other way?
Potentially, but what generally happens, so to answer your question, yes, it happens all the time. I mean, just the statistics of the number of seeds that are going to come out of this, you're going to end up in scenarios where, yes, you are going to have agronomically strong varieties, but economically or from a brewing quality standpoint, they're just not up to snuff.
Yep.
And that's, or it's not what brewers are looking for right now. So you take that variety and you put it on the shelf until trends change. And then you march that one back out and you release it again. And suddenly it's something that people want right now.
Right.
So this idea of we're going to breed our own hop, it's just rolls off the tongue so easily. You know, like, sure, why wouldn't I? This makes total sense. You know, hey, everybody's doing it. Just the logistics alone to get enough crosses and volume to, even if you were extraordinarily, exquisitely lucky, and in three crosses, you got something that was agronomically viable and economically viable, how much do you have in that at this point?
Yeah,
because, you know, we are counting our labor.
we are. And I mean, you kept on coming back to the number of plants. There's an opportunity cost. It's a portion of your field that could have gone to Brewer's Gold.
Right. Right.
You know, it could have gone to something.
Or it's a new part of the field that now you have to go and maintain. But the people that are maintaining it also have to be skilled in observation.
Yeah.
Because these observations will make or break your program.
That's a very good point, because it's not just like your other varieties that you're growing for a profit, where it's make sure there's no mildew, make sure you don't see any aphids. This is more than that. It's significantly more than that, because you're looking for anything that might tell you that there's a positive or a negative going on here.
So let's go back to when I started talking about the F1 hybrid, and that was like the first generation.
Yep.
So if any of the listeners are aware of what we call ascension numbers, and so if you look at hop varieties, and usually under a variety that's been patented, it will list its ascension number. It's usually like a 7-digit number, 8-digit number. Sometimes there's some letters in it, based as an abbreviation from where it was developed. That's an identifier that you could provide the patent clerk the key to the table, so that they could trace back through your data the deliberate crosses that you made to invent something new. If you do not have that, nor can you prove that, you have nothing. So all that work that you just went through and all that effort, if you can't prove it, you have nothing to patent. I get a little bit irritated, you know, when I hear, like, at conferences or on forums where people get, oh, we're going to put this group together, we're going to start breeding, blah, 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 blah. You have no idea what you're getting yourself into if you really want to make a good go at it.
Yeah. And make it repeatable.
Yeah. This is not something that, if your intention is to develop intellectual property, you can't go at it as a hobbyist. You have to go at it with the right investment in people and in equipment and in time. If you want to do that, knock yourself out. There's absolutely, well, I mean, Select Botanicals Group has shown there's a market for these things. So by all means, go for it. But I'm hoping now that when we say to bring a new variety to market is 10 years and $1 million, I'm not joking at all. You know, I think most recently a university, I think it's in Vineland up in Ontario, where someone went to them to say, develop me a new hop variety. they're like, okay, we can develop one. We can't guarantee you it's going to be economically or brewing quality viable, but we'll develop you one that's agronomically viable, right? And it's going to be like $700,000. And it's going to take us at least 5 years. And that's just what it costs to do it right. So for all of you out there that are crestfallen now, and Captain Bringdown is about ready to take off.
Mm-hmm.
There's still other routes. You still don't have to go through that to get a plant patent. Because remember, that patent's only good for 22 years. And after that, it's game on. You have no claim to the intellectual property anymore. So there's other ways to protect your creations. But they're just not necessarily as clear, cut and dried as patents are. But the reason patents are cut and dried because of all the data that has to go behind proving you actually created something and didn't find it growing in a ditch.
Yeah, and that I think is probably quite the misconception of, you know, I come back to my deck hops again and, hey, we found this wild variety, you know, can we patent it? No, because you didn't make it. You found
some
it.
Some people are going to say, what about Amarillo, and wasn't that a found variety in a field and blah blah blah? I'm like, that was probably a naturally occurring triploid out of some farmer's field, and you know what, whoever that was, they submitted whatever evidence they had and they were granted a patent. Could you fight it if you wanted to? You probably could. Do you have enough money to do that? No, you do not. And even if you did, why? Mm-hmm. So yeah, sometimes mistakes do happen, but for the vast majority of the time, certainly from like our friends at Select Botanicals and Jason Peralt and his team, who do just outstanding science. There's a process, there's a cost, and there's an opportunity. And you got to make sure that you balance all those in order to at least have some degree of confidence that what you're going to come out of in the back end is going to be able to return at least some of your investment.
Sure, sure. And to your point, I mean, so much variability in what's coming out. I mean, the economically viable versus the physically, I'll call it viable. Mm-hmm. Your example about it not being able to train was, I thought, very powerful, because you go down a certain path and it's, oh crap, this plant can't grow.
Mm-hmm.
It just can't do it.
Grows great as a shrub on the ground, but yeah, maybe it's got ornamental potential. I don't know,
mm-hmm.
but it's not going to work so good for beer.
Hop shrub. I just rewatched Spinal Tap.